From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Stockton, California.
I live next door to Bob Saget.
Selma.
Rockridge.
Tracy, California.
Noe Valley.
Everywhere, I'm homeless.
Coming up, we're going to get the latest on a possible BART strike.
We do not want a strike. We do not want the disruption of service. And that is why we're not giving a 72-hour notice at this time, because we want to leave every opportunity open to try and get this deal done.
Then we'll visit a neighborhood garden in an unexpected place.
Oh, yes, there's a lot of dead grass, weeds. It had all kinds of debris.
And the inspirational story of the skipper who won the America's Cup.
If it wasn't hard, if it wasn't demanding, if it wasn't challenging, it just wouldn't be as worthwhile.
We're getting all around the Bay today on Cross Currents. The federal government is still partially shut down. And here in the Bay Area, we may get another shutdown. The second BART strike in 3 months could start this Friday if the transit agency doesn't reach a deal with its unions by midnight on Thursday. That's when the 60-day cooling-off period Governor Jerry Brown ordered back in August is going to end. In the last few weeks, the two sides have moved a lot closer to a deal, though they're still separated by millions of dollars. KLW's transportation reporter Isabel Angel is here with us to give us an update on these negotiations. And obviously the $64,000 question is, Isabel, is there going to be a strike?
So short answer is we don't know.
That's very helpful. I'm so glad we've got you out reporting on this.
Basically, they're closer than they were last time when they went on strike. But, you know, will they reach a deal by the end? We're not sure. Here is ATU Local 1555 president Antoinette Bryant. She represents the station agents and train operators. She's talking at a press conference on Monday.
We do not want a strike. We do not want the disruption of service. And that is why we're not giving a 72-hour notice at this time, because we want to leave every opportunity open to try and get this deal done. We are keeping all options on the table.
And that's Union Rep Antoinette Bryant. So what's the update?
So this is a good sign that they're not issuing the 72-hour notice, but it doesn't mean they won't go on strike. The 72-hour notice is a courtesy, and so by not issuing it, I think they're really trying to say, we really want to get a deal done, we don't want to disrupt the service, but at the same time, if they don't reach a deal, they will go on strike if they have it authorized.
So you say that the two sides are a lot closer. How far apart are they still?
So that really depends on who you ask. Both sides are respecting the gag order right now, so they're not talking about their positions publicly. But the last thing we had was the union said they were $30 million apart, and BART said they were $89 million apart. So they can't even agree on the math right now. But that's mostly because the unions want a 3-year contract and BART wants a 4-year contract. So that kind of makes up most of the difference.
And so there's a lot of talk about raises. That's one of the negotiation points. What do BART workers actually make?
So the average blue-collar BART worker, somebody like a station agent or a mechanic or a janitor, they make an average of $76,000 a year. That's pretty similar to Chicago and New York transit workers, but BART workers have better benefits. So that puts them above among the highest-paid transit workers in the country. The unions argue that the Bay Area is one of the most expensive places to live, and that they didn't get a raise last time. So, a raise this time, they deserve it.
And back in August, which was the last time it looked like the unions were going to strike again, Governor Brown stepped in and he issued this 60-day cooling off period. So could the governor just do that again and avoid this whole thing?
No, that was a one-time thing. The only thing that could stop a strike now is a ban on transit strikes. And while that's a longer-term solution that wouldn't help us here on Friday if there's no deal, some people are looking into it, like Orinda City Council member Steve Glazer. He says it's too big of a disruption in the Bay Area, and he's really pushing for a ban.
Major transit systems in the United States have bans on transit strikes. Those areas include New York, Massachusetts, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and even in the city of San Francisco. San Francisco Muni is banned from striking. So a ban on transit strikes is a common thing around the country. Of course, we do not have that in California, which creates this consequence of and the potential of BART striking and all its impacts.
That's Orinda City Council member Steve Glazer, who's running for state assembly. So how do BART workers and management like that option that Glazer is proposing?
You know, neither side likes this option. The unions don't like it because it takes away their biggest bargaining chip. They won't be able to go on strike. And management doesn't like it either because it's somebody else coming in and telling them how to negotiate. You know, they just don't want to have that extra third party regulating them. Going into these last couple days of negotiating, the public, it has been pretty anti-union especially since that first strike when it disrupted about 200,000 people trying to get to work, trying to get to school or whatever. In a poll by the Bay Area Council, which is pro-business, they found that about two-thirds of people think the unions should take BART's deal, and only 6% thought that BART should accept the union's deal.
What do you think about a possible BART strike? Do you have any advice for either side? You can let us know by calling 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. From the outside, San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood might seem like a dangerous and unfriendly place. Of course, that depends on how you're looking at it. Though the neighborhood does have some of the city's highest rates of violence, it also has year-round sunshine, one of the city's highest rates of home ownership, and dozens of community-organized projects. Many of these projects are transforming the landscape and bringing people together who normally may not cross paths. KLW's Jen Chien has the story of how one small neighborly action grew exponentially into a safer street and a stronger community.
Look at that. Ooh-wee, that's pretty.
Like many people who see a pretty rose in bloom, Annette Smith likes to take in the sight and scent of it. But her enjoyment of this particular rose bush in this particular garden comes with a deeper meaning.
That was one that Chris Montgomery gave us.
Annette knows the stories behind most of the plants growing in the Quesada Gardens project, which is on the median strip of Quesada Avenue off of busy 3rd Street and the Bayview. The mostly single-family houses on either side of the street face lush greenery, flowers, and even some fruits and vegetables. But Annette remembers what it was like before it was a garden.
Oh, yes, it was a lot of dead grass, weeds. It had all kinds of debris.
Annette moved onto this block in the late 90s. Her brother, who was already there, told her about an apartment opening near him. Back then, the median strip was bare, except for garbage. The block was also at that time a hub for a bustling drug trade, with the violence, prostitution, and despair that often goes along with it.
Anytime, day or night, you see somebody walking along like zombies because they were so out of it.
Annette says that toxic atmosphere left a lot of people afraid to come outside. That's how things were when Jeffrey Betcher moved onto the street, a little after Annette did. Although some of Jeffrey's friends were worried for him, a gay white man moving into historically black Bayview, he says his race and sexual orientation were never an issue. His problem was the same one Annette described.
People were living in isolation. They were fearful. I was. We all were.
Jeffrey moved in next door to Annette's brother, Woody, and that's how the two met. They hit it off from the start. One day in early 2002, Jeffrey came home from work to find that something was different about the median in front of his house. Woody Smith had dug up a patch of grass, looking for worms to use as fishing bait, and Annette had felt bad about the mess he'd made. So she and another neighbor, Carl Page, decided to take advantage of the turned earth and planted some collard greens and then some flowers.
I felt that the flower would look better than the dirt out there that he had dug up.
Soon, Annette and Carl were gardening every day, and the median started to look a little brighter. Jeffrey says it wasn't long before other neighbors started coming outside to ask about what was happening, and then they started to pitch in. Some had experience with gardening and dug right in. Others hung out and gave moral support through conversation or just a thumbs up as they drove past. People on the block were seeing something they hadn't seen before, right outside their front doors.
And these smiling faces and people not afraid to give people hugs and shake hands, and that changed the world very quickly.
So Annette and Carl gardened in little plots along the median for about a year, helped along by Jeffrey and others, all on an ad hoc basis. Then, in 2003, a meeting took place on Quesada Avenue. A group of about 30 residents got together in one neighbor's backyard to talk about what was going on the block. Jeffrey says he thought for sure that drug dealing was going to be everyone's top issue. But some people thought that rats were a more pressing problem, or the recent surge in mosquitoes.
The one thing that we could agree on was that there was already beauty and strength here in this community, and Carl and Annette were showing us that in the garden.
They chose the name Quesada Gardens Initiative at that first meeting. Well, actually, they chose the name Quesada Gardens Initiative. Although it's a Spanish street name, historically there weren't a lot of Spanish speakers in the neighborhood, so some of the locals pronounce it differently. Neighbors started bringing plants from their own backyards to the garden, and there were donations from nurseries.
A whole lot of different plants, flowers, shrubbery.
Jeffrey had experience in nonprofit administration, so he started doing things like working on the organization's tax status and getting the attention of media and funders. There was some initial resistance from city officials who seemed wary of unsanctioned items being placed on city land, but they soon came around when they saw the value the gardens brought to the block.
They didn't have to send anybody out there to cut the grass or anything because we were doing all the work.
And the beautification of the physical space helped to fill in something that had been missing from the block before.
And for me, it was knowing my neighbors, busting through that isolation.
The effects of the garden also spread to other parts of the neighborhood. Joel and Mary McClure live a short distance up the hill from the Quesada Gardens on Bridgeview Street. They have a great view from their house, but right outside their living room window was an empty lot owned by the city. Here's Mary.
People would use it as a trash dump.
From their outdoor deck, the McClures could see the swaying palms and blooming flowers of the Quesada Gardens.
So you would see all this beauty on this side, and then we would go to the other side of our house, and you would just see this horrible weed-infested lot. And then finally we just said, that's it, we got to do something, and it's going to be us.
The McClures were able to secure permission, assistance, and a water source from the city. But Joel says he was mostly inspired by the do-it-yourself attitude of the Quesada Gardens neighbors.
Can't also always keep asking the government to do things for us, specifically when it's right there in our backyard.
So the McClures, their neighbors, and some dedicated student volunteers got to work turning the trash-filled lot into a terraced garden, much of it producing fruits and vegetables for the neighbors. Mary and Joel say they enjoy the gardening, but what they get out of it is something bigger.
Quite honestly, up until about 2003, we didn't really know any of our neighbors, and we'd been in our house for like 3 years.
One of the neighbors Mary met was 10-year-old Serenity Williams, who lives across the street on Bridgeview.
I was at home, I looked out the window, and I saw people working in the garden, and I asked my mom, can I help? And then Mary said, yes.
Serenity started gardening every week. Her favorite task is watering the plants. Jeffrey Betcher says he feels a real sense of safety on his block now, and that he can't imagine living anywhere else.
People respond differently to everything when they're on a block where they have a sense that people know one another, people are looking out for each other.
At this point, the Quesada Gardens Initiative projects include 2 murals, 6 community gardens throughout the neighborhood, and Bayview Footprints, a weekly newsletter that highlights good news in the neighborhood.
We're trying to do good things and trying to pass it on to the next block so they can do good things for them to pass it on.
And though about half the homes on that first block of Quesada have changed residents since Annette and Carl planted those first collard greens, the spirit of neighborliness and safety they helped to foster has continued to grow and bloom. In Bayview Hunters Point, I'm Jen Sheehan for Cross Currents.
That story was produced for the Sights and Sounds of Bayview Project, a KALW collaboration with the San Francisco Arts Commission. You can find more stories about the neighborhood at kalw.org. Just click on Sights and Sounds of Bayview. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. In another part of Bayview at Pier 80, you'll find the headquarters for Oracle Team USA, champions of the recently held America's Cup. The competition, which ended last month, saw some of the world's fastest sailboats whipping through the bay. The America's Cup races were fast. The catamarans reached speeds of nearly 50 knots. That's over 50 miles per hour. It pushed some of the best sailors in the world to their limits.
But that's what happens when your sailboat's like this. You're at the limit. You're on the red line. There's no sort of half speed. It's full throttle or nothing. And that's exactly the way we were sailing.
That's Jimmy Spithill, a San Francisco resident and captain of Oracle Team USA. After pitch poling one of the boats in practice, upending it in the bay, he led his team to a dramatic victory in the best of 17 race competition, winning the oldest international sporting trophy with one of the greatest sporting comebacks in history. KALW's Ben Trefney met with the skipper to hear that story. Take it away, mate.
So we are just 15 seconds away from the moment where the entire sailing world holds its breath. It's Oracle Team USA to leeward, Emirates Team New Zealand to windward. They approach the line for the start of race number one of the 34th America's Cup.
What were you thinking in anticipation of the race's beginning?
I was thinking this is going to be the fight of our lives. We're going against the world's best team that has been so dominant. We had a fantastic team. And, you know, it's almost like, you know, Rumble in the Jungle. I mean, it's just going to be two of the biggest heavyweights going head-to-head.
All of the fans here in San Francisco and at America's Cup Park and around the world and certainly down at that tiny nation of New Zealand will be cheering huge right now. The first race of the America's Cup goes to Emirates Team New Zealand.
What experience did you draw from, say, when you saw New Zealand finish that first race first? What experience did you come back to in your life of sailing?
Well, I came back to the fact that the feat is nothing but education. So, man, we're going to have a long night of learning here and learning from our competitors.
Did you go back to your youth or any experience, like maybe in your childhood or as you're becoming more of an elite sailor? I'm wondering if there was a specific thing that you were drawing back from.
Yeah, there was. It was actually when we capsized boat one. And, you know, we... You know, and me personally, I was responsible for that. So, you know, you just sort of see, when you see a boat that guys have put tens of thousands of hours into, blood, sweat and tears, and then you go out there and pretty much destroy that in the blink of an eye, well, how is the team going to react? And for, I think, any lesser team, it wouldn't be that bad of an excuse to split up and say, oh, well, look, that's over, or for a team to point the finger or, you know, start questioning guys. But that's not this team. What did this team do? Mate, the shore team, a boat building team, engineering team, and the sailing team pulled each other tighter in and said, hey, let's get through this. You know, we can get through this. We'll be stronger for this. And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, you really have to see, you know I've said it before, but you really, to see what people are really about and their true colours, you've got to see them in a, you know, almost a life or death situation.
Was that the most traumatic event you've ever had as a sailor?
That's right up there for sure. It'd be that, and then once we got stuck in a big storm, I remember, in a big offshore race down in Australia in a Sydney to Hobart where a lot of guys died and boats were sunk, you know, in a huge storm. But yeah, that was right up there.
What was that experience like?
Well, it was just, you know, it started off in good conditions. We got in the middle of Bass Strait, which is down in the you know, the Southern Ocean. And
it's a different kind of boat.
Yeah, sort of an offshore boat. And, you know, like offshore sailing, it's kind of like mountain climbing. When you're out there and you get in that sort of a situation, there's, you know, there's no one that can really come out and save you.
What were the conditions? What was happening in that?
Oh, it was, you know, 80 knots of wind, 100-foot waves, breaking a lot of them, and you couldn't see land. You know, it was surreal.
Did you think you were going to die?
No. I thought if it kept getting any worse, I didn't know how we were going to get through it. It just kept ramping up and ramping up, and at some point you're just looking around going, man, if one of these waves breaks on us and they've just got our number, there's nothing we can do about it. But the thing that, you know, I remember thinking was, man, I've got some of the best guys in the world here. I've got a great boat, and, you know, if anyone can get through it, we can.
That's Jimmy Spithill. He's skipper of the champion America's Cup team, Oracle Team USA.
Day number 8, race number 11, belongs to Emirates Team New Zealand. The Kiwis now just one win away from the America's Cup.
When Emirates Team New Zealand crossed that finish line to go up 8-1, what were you thinking then?
I was thinking, oh, well, people better start changing their flights because we're going to have to use all 17 races.
You didn't feel any panic or any concern?
I'd say the team felt more comfortable and relaxed when they got to 8-1 than when they were at 4-1. I mean, for some reason, the people in this team just seemed to thrive on facing the gun, you know, or thrive on that match point, you know, looking at the feet. It's when there's super high pressure, it just seems like this team operates better then.
Wouldn't it be less stressful to do it a different way?
Well, I said to the guys after we won this one, I said, next time we're doing it 9 straight from the start.
So let's go up to the day of the final race. And we knew it was going to be the final race, especially because the weather got really nice, right?
It doesn't get any better. I mean, it's kind of like turning up the pipeline if you're a surfer and it's 20 to 30 foot perfect glass barrels. You know, it was sunny. It was 20 knots of wind. It was just set up to be the ultimate winner-takes-all main event.
And then coming off the line, well, before, I mean, because the race starts before you hit the starting line. So what were you thinking then as you were coming down to this ultimate moment?
Well, many people don't know this, but you get about an hour sailing before from the dockout show to when you get on the racetrack and before the start. And we had a huge failure in our wing. It was almost touch and go whether we were going to be able to, you know, race. So we had a guy up the wing injecting carbon epoxy. We had guys grinding carbon plate on the back to make a repair that we finished with about 5 minutes to go. And so we didn't have the ideal preparation to get ready for that start. The guys pulled off the repair and then we were just trying to, you know, get our heads together and get back into the race.
What a show for the people on the shoreline here in San Francisco Bay and for sailors and non-sailors alike around the world. This is a comeback like international sport may have never seen before. Oracle has pace.
And at what point did you feel like you were going to win it?
When we crossed the finish line and the gun went off.
You were going full bore until then?
Red line, 100%, full throttle the whole way to the end. I mean, that's the only way I think you can do it in sport, and certainly on these boats, there's no other way.
The Stars and Stripes say it all. The comeback of 2013 is complete. America's Cup will stay in America.
And then what was the feeling when he crossed that line there?
Oh, mate, I mean, it's just a mixture of, you know, pure ecstasy. I mean, adrenaline, the relief, your other teammates come alongside in the chase boats. You just look into everyone's faces and see them. It's why you do it. There's no question. I mean, that whole experience, when you pull off 3 years of hard work, face all this adversity, you can't put it into words.
So what do you do from here?
It's a bit depressing, isn't it? What do you do from here? I mean, look, that's probably the hardest thing, I think, for all of the athletes and the sportsmen and the team, is when you operate like that for over 20 days without a break, you know, that sort of adrenaline and pressure and, you know, every single day at that level, then you stop and you wake up and you honestly don't know what to do with yourself. You know, you're just like, well, we're not going out on the boat, you know, what are we going to do? And it's, it's just ironic how you go from that to stopping, but hey, it's a good problem to have.
Take it away there, Slade, beat it out. Yacht club swingers in boat now.
That's Oracle Team USA skipper Jimmy Spithill. He spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. There was a lot of talk about the America's Cup while it was happening, but now that it's all over, what do you think about it? You can share your point of view about the America's Cup at our Facebook page. We are KALW. And that's it for today's edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Isabel Angel, Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Seth Samuel, Leela Day, Alyssa Kapnick, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Daniel Moore, Melanie Young, Jasmine Lopez, Laura Flynn, Raisu Sussman, Charlotte Silver, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by the great Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our senior producer is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney, of course, is our executive editor. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported, commercial-free public radio. The sounds you're hearing are by composer Cheryl Leonard. Leonard is the opening performer for Resonance at the Exploratorium, a bimonthly series hosted by Sarah Cahill, who also hosts Revolutions Per Minute, heard Sunday evenings on KALW. The new Resonance music series begins tomorrow evening at the Exploratorium, starting at 7 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.